Yeah, it is. Okay, so let me say thank you very much for having me on. I've really enjoyed your channel and I've learned a lot from it. And I appreciate the videos you made about my forthcoming, you know, being forthcoming about my spirituality. Like I was saying, I was a little reluctant to do it. It felt a little bit too personal. But then, you know, like when I was doing it, I sort of just did it as an afterthought in that video. And then it just felt right. So I left it.
And, I'm glad you did, because I thought, as I just said, I think actually the internet rewards self-disclosure for better or for worse sometimes.
Right.
but in a case like this, you know, one of the things that I've realized, both in terms of I'm a pastor in real life and outside of this YouTube land, that it's so helpful for us to hear from each other. And
it really is.
And no matter, I know, for me, so I've started meetups and things, and for me, the main thing is, well, let's just talk honestly with each other. And what do you think? And how have you gotten to this place? And I find I didn't start out expecting to be a YouTuber, but there seems to be an audience and a hunger for people to talk about their spiritual journeys and how they've gotten into these places. So your last little U2 cents worth, I've used it in two separate videos because
I thought it was
really helpful. I mean, we could talk about what Peugeot and Fervaeke and all these folks think, but people want to know what regular people, and as if Peugeot and Vervaeke aren't regular people, but people want to know. So I think it's helpful.
Yeah, and I think so too. And I like YouTube a lot, you know, just even as a kind of form of social media, because, you know, you really have to put, you don't just post like a meme or something. You really have to put thought into it.
Yeah.
And so it's very different from the problems that you have with regular social media, which is just such instant gratification. This isn't like that. You really have to, you know, you have to put hours into, you know, often one video if you're doing the research and everything. So it's like social media that's really going to work for the better. And
no, I think so too.
Yeah. And it creates these communities. I mean, I'm certainly not here to have a big channel or anything. I'm here for a community with people I can talk to about this stuff, because it's hard to find people, you know, to share some of these kind of narrow interests, let's just say. So I'm really appreciative.
Well, and that was the same with me. I mean, most of the conversations like we're doing now, I had no plan for any of this, but people need to talk. And again, I know that as a pastor, I spend, you know, time as a pastor just listening to people share who they are. But one of the interesting things that I've learned is that in a church, because people might lose status by saying the wrong thing, people don't disclose. They're afraid to disclose. And a lot of churches complain about that, but it's part of human society. And in a sense, this false world of the internet gives a little bit more freedom to disclose. So I don't think we fully understand what's going on, but I think so far it's actually been a pretty good thing.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So people who watch my channel know about me. Maybe I'll do a little introduction in case you want to use this video too. Okay. My name is Paul Vanderclay. I'm the pastor of Livingstone's Christian Reformed Church in Sacramento, California. I started making videos partly just playing with YouTube. I started with the Freddie and Paul show.
I love the Freddie and Paul show.
And because Freddie said to me one day, he says, "You and me should have a TV show." And it was like, I don't think that's going to happen, Fred. Why don't we just do a little show on my cell phone and I'll post it on YouTube, and that way Freddie could watch and he could share with friends. And so I had about 15 subscribers. And then I had posted, just because members would miss a Sunday, and so I'd post my sermons on YouTube just so people could find them. And then I got interested in Jordan Peterson and made a video about that. And I too expected I might have some new interesting conversation partners. It's really what I was looking for. I didn't expect how many conversation partners I would have. And so that sort of rearranged my life a bit, not too much, which I'm very grateful for. So, and that's how I started doing this. And early on, I saw that you had done a video. You started reading C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I watched that video, and then lately John Vervaeke sent out a tweet that you had done a video on He and Peugeot. And I thought that's, I really love that video because
Thank you.
I think you're exactly right. There's both of them are in a, sort of unlike Jordan Peterson, who took this status rocket out of availability for most of us. Both Jonathans are available and interacting quite a bit with regular folks like you and I. And the conversation, I think, is extremely helpful. So yeah. I watched that video of yours, and after I watched that, I thought, boy, I really want to talk to you and get into some of this stuff. But before that, I was just curious because I didn't even know your name because, you know, it's a social media. But
yeah.
I was curious about, okay, well, tell me about how you got to this place, and then we can get into what you're doing and maybe kick some of that around. That's sort of my rough draft.
All right, so I'll talk a little bit about my channel, and then I'll share with you, I guess, my spiritual journey.
That'd be great.
Make sense? Okay, sure. So at one point, and it's in you know what I describe in the spiritual journey, I just really got into the book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. It just really resonated. I mean, everything, you know, when you read something and you just feel like it's true, it's like an embodied sense of truth. And I guess I read it at the right point in my life. You know, it was fairly recently. I'm in my 50s now, so I think I was maybe at the end of my 40s. And for where I was, it was just right. And I'd wanted to do YouTubes for a long time just because, you know, there's so many cool ideas out there and to comment on stuff that was going on. But I can't even say exactly how I got started. I think it probably had partially had to do with being interested in Jordan Peterson and seeing that other people were jumping on that. And it's funny, and you were one of the first people I saw during that time when I was thinking about doing that. And I remember the day your channel took off and you suddenly woke up and there's 2,000 subscribers. I remember that video. Oh no, is this going to change my life?
But just a little bit. That's been good.
And it's funny because I was really, so I was going from one career to another, and it's funny. I was actually watching Jordan Peterson back when he had like 500 subscribers because his lectures are really interesting. And I remember when that happened too, like the next day woke up and he was famous, you know, C16 or whatever it was. So, so with this channel, because I'm a mental health professional, I'm a therapist. I find that when people are not connected to something spiritual, let's just say, that dimension, I think maybe if you used a secular term, it might be the noetic dimension, like what Viktor Frankl calls it. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to not feel like life is just bobbing you around on the waves, you know, that you're so dependent on your environment for your happiness. And that if you can access something to where you can transcend that in some way, it makes it much more sense that you can actually transform in therapy. And so my interest with Persig is because it resonated so completely with me. So I felt like I was touching the bottom of reality with this stuff. And so I'm not an expert in Persig by any stretch of the imagination. I'm thrilled that people are helping me with this, that people are helping me with the metaphysics of quality, which is kind of difficult to apply to real life. And I'm thinking, you know, if I can apply this kind of thing, if I can take this and turn it into something in therapy, it would be really useful. But I would say that spiritual work in general, and I advertise myself as someone who uses spiritual interventions in my work, that it just makes things much more effective. I don't know how else to say it. I just feel
exactly what Peterson says too.
Mm-hmm. I feel compelled to do this in this direction. So That's kind of a little bit. So I'm working it out, let's just say, and help, people are helping me with it. And I'm no expert, but, you know, it's a work in progress.
So did you say spiritual intervention?
Well, intervention just means like what method are you going to use to help the person in that session?
Okay.
So, you know, it would be things, a lot of people, because I'm in a big urban area, they tend to be atheists, so, but they do kind of, they can kind of connect with Buddhism.
Okay.
So some of the Buddhist practices.
So now when you, I have to ask you this question. So when you say spiritual, what do you mean?
Okay, it's funny because to prepare myself to speak with you, I listened to a lot of your videos, and there's one in which, let me just find it, because you said, first of all, there's the God one and two, which is very interesting, but you said Jordan Peterson can't connect quite with the spiritual dimension, or you said that he can't go all the way there.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that on the one hand, I totally get what you're saying. On the other hand, there's a sort of, let's go back to the Frankl noetic dimension, you know, that I think I'm thinking that just because the situation I'm in, there isn't all that much organized, people don't connect so much with organized religion. So, you know, that dimension that transcends the material world, let's just say.
And what is that?
I know.
Well, and I have God one and two. I almost need spirit one and two.
Uh-huh.
Because that is, so I grew up in the New York metropolitan area, but I grew up in, so my father was pastoring a church mostly of black folks,
mm-hmm.
Patterson, New Jersey, but the church, the tradition of the church, as was my father and my mother's upbringing, was a sort of enclave Dutch Calvinism. And actually, I just did a very interesting conversation with a guy living in New York City right now, which I'm going to post on my mm-hmm. channel. I try to keep my conversations in order a little bit. But he was talking about living in New York City and basically the secularity of it. And your comment now about, you know, many of the people that you see, the clients that you work with, they're not practicing a religion.
Mm-hmm. For the most part, yeah.
For the most part. Mm-hmm. And of course, that to me, I find that incredibly interesting, partly because having grown up in an enclave that was very religious, yet always living in contexts that were highly secular, I'm always interested in those liminal spaces between those two communities where people try to understand each other using very different frameworks. You know, Viktor Frankl has been a guy who has fascinated me for a long time. I read him long before I ever found Peterson. I actually read him after listening to Tim Keller talk quite a bit about him. So Tim Keller is a pastor, a very conservative, he's Presbyterian, so he's English Reformed pastor, also in a highly secular place. So part of the meaning crisis that has really fascinated me is this observation that Peterson has made and you just made, mm-hmm. that, you know, it's in a sense that people can't live without spirit.
Yeah.
But that spirit becomes, you know, so as a pastor, you get to see various relationships in various stages of dysfunction work their way through. Mm-hmm. And it's always it's, you know, so often in a marriage or in a relationship between a parent and a child, it's always the things you can't talk about that are, of course, where the real action is happening. And so as a mm-hmm. culture, that's sort of where we're at, I think. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, it's funny because the first thing I think of is, you know, when Peterson says, you know, like Jung said, in filth it will be found. You have to go there. You know, you have to go down into the shadow to really understand what's going on. You can't avoid it. And we avoid it.
We do, for good reasons. Yeah. For good reasons, we shouldn't. No. And you know, part of, so I'm currently reading a book, Fatal Discord, which is the story of Erasmus and Luther. I'm mm-hmm. reading that. I'm always reading too many books at the same time. And I'm also reading this other book by Mark Vernon, who goes into, why can't I think of it? I said barman, but that's not it. And everybody in the comment section will know it's C.S. Lewis's friend, Barfield. Owen Barfield. Gets into the question of language and such. And, you know, there are 500-year reasons why we can't talk about this. And whether or not we're schooled in it, that's still true.
Mm-hmm.
That's an amazing idea. Well, I'm talking too much. I want to hear more from you. So you work in the mental health field. You're a therapist. Mm-hmm. You see clients, and you got into doing this YouTube thing. You found Peterson early. How did you find Peterson?
Well, I was looking. Jung is hard to understand.
Yeah, I've learned that.
So I said, I've got to find something to help me with this because I just don't get it. And I found him. And then, you know, in this personality series, he does a thing on Frankel. He does a thing on Carl Rogers. His other course is Maps of Meaning. And, you know, the meaning was really standing out to me because I was getting into Frankel. At that time, I was at a mental health agency, which I remained affiliated with for a long time. And we were using that book a lot with people, and that's just as a segue, that's kind of a difference. Is you could use spiritual interventions a lot in the community health setting, but in the private practice world, it's a very different thing. It's just
why, how, flesh that out. I'm curious.
It's just in the more people who are less affluent, that group of people. And I think maybe the church that kind of the area you grew up in New York, there's no problem with religion and spirituality. It's a big part of life.
Yeah.
And I learned so much from those people, you know, about this and how it's used to actually help with mental health issues, with other issues. And so I forgot where I was going with this, but
private practice versus
that very affluent people in a major urban setting, I mean, atheism is a big thing, you know, and it's I'm atheist and I'm proud, and so it's been kind of a challenge to integrate it, but for me, I don't see any other way. I think that this is the way to do it. I think that when someone's really stuck, to not be able to access that part of themselves is really, it's a pity, and it makes things difficult.
It's very interesting. I often think about, so one of my friends who comes to the meetup, who watches my videos, he's the same one who said some of my conversations are boring. He's got a PhD in neuropsychology. And one of the things he mentioned to me, he said one day, he says, well, you know, on these conversations, you're doing therapy. And actually I said, well, I don't really see it that way. Partly because, you know, pastors, and you're very right about affluence in this country, because people who very quickly, when you dip your toe into the mental health field, you realize a lot of finding a therapist that will take whatever cruddy insurance you have, that's a whole different thing than if you're able to pay pay for therapy for years. Well, you've got to be pretty affluent for that. Mm-hmm. And so many people who in a community like this one who don't have that kind of money, well, it's the pastor and it's church and it's their friends. And so So pastors are often seen sort of as, well, you can kind of get free therapy from a pastor, but one of the things that's drilled into us when we're in divinity school is that you're not a therapist. And I'm not a therapist. My training in psychology, you know, apart from what I've learned just on my own, you know, is about this deep. And so what we do as pastors more often, this is where Jung gets interesting. Mm-hmm. What we do as pastors more often is we tend to be archaeologists of people's stories.
Yeah.
And so I sit down with someone and I get them talking, and I spend a lot of time when I'm with people one-on-one just listening to their story and asking them questions. And I'm not using categories of modern psychology. I'm generally speaking using categories of religion. And it just fascinates me, this observation that I first heard from Peterson at that objectivist group that already had a panel discussion when he made this comment, and now you. And after reading just a bit of Jung, I find this a fascinating observation. And I, you know, although I did watch The Sopranos, and that show, not only just being from Northern New Jersey, so it was like, I know lots of guys like Tony Soprano. I got to be careful with that. But watching him and Dr. Melfi, you know, negotiate, okay, so if I help Tony with his anxiety and I make him a better mobster, what does that mean? And so suddenly these categories, these contemporary categories that we have of public and private, well, those lines begin to blur. And the big story and the small story, which is, you know, sort of what I got from Jung, well, the relationship between these two things, pretty important for anything that we would associate with health. So.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's such a connection. There's such a mind-body, There's such a mind-body connection these days. I mean, they're absolutely finding that out.
So now you, and I don't want to, you know, because we're gonna air this on YouTube. So I don't want, no, you're a therapist. You got a good filter. I'm not going to. Pastors, you know, one of the differences between pastors and therapists is our, do I know English? One of the differences is that pastors sort of live in the same realm with their clients.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Whereas sometimes I have a therapist in my church, and I tell her sometimes, I said, I could never do your job, because to sit in a room all day long and just listen to people talk, like do that all day long, I could do it for 4 or 5 hours a day maybe, but not eight. And I'd stand up and yell at the people. But as a pastor, and she kind of looks at me like, yeah, but you swim with them. You know, you don't have this nice box, which is the door that lets you into this room, and you're disconnected from this person. So, but, okay, so you do this for a living, but you obviously, did you grow up in church or with spirituality, or how did that?
Well, that's interesting, because I was baptized in the Washington National Cathedral Episcopal before it was even finished.
Wow!
And the minister was my grandparents' best friend. So my parents were into being Episcopalian. It was absolutely part of their upbringing. But my father was in the Foreign Service, so they went away for a while in the early 70s. And when they came back, they said, you know, we just can't handle this. They've got guitars in church and the macrame and all that stuff. And it's just not formal enough. So they kind of, I'm afraid they kind of abandoned it. Interestingly, my father, we were posted to Greece, and my father became really captivated with Byzantine art, you know, like icons, like what Jonathan Peugeot produces. And so I grew up with that imagery around me. And I think, you know, my father's been dead for quite some time, so I couldn't ask him, but I believe that he connected to the living God of the Orthodox Church. I feel like that was something that he was a spiritual person, and I believe that was something that he was very interested in. He didn't go there, but the imagery and his interest was very much part of that. So after that, I mean, I guess I sort of, it was really in style to be very atheistic, you know, for someone my age, you know, in the 70s and in the 80s, especially, you know, with postmodernism. I went to art school in the 80s. So making fun of religious imagery and being very subversive with it, you know, this was the era of the piss Christ, if you remember that.
Yeah.
You know, that really degenerate, degrading Christian art, and we all thought that was very funny. You know, I feel bad. You know,
I'm a pastor. There is forgiveness. You were young.
Thank God. But that, you know, like all this postmodern stuff you're hearing about now with Jordan Peterson talking, and just how nihilistic it is, and how it just leads to something really, you know, really empty. That's what was going on at the time. I was in art school in New York, and this is when, you know, you put some dog excrement in the middle of a room and you call it something grandiose. You know, it was really bad. So I totally understand this whole problem with postmodernism from the aesthetic point of view. And later, of course, I understood it through the cultural point of view. So when I was around 40, I wandered into an Episcopal church, and this was high Episcopal. So it was very, it was like a Catholic church in a lot of ways. And there was just something about it, and something was kind of happening to me. I don't know how to explain it. And I'm sure that many of the people you've interviewed say something like this, that there was just something brewing. And it started to express itself in me. And I told my father about it. I said, I might be interested in this. And he was really pleased. It was shortly before he died. I'm happy about that. And then I kind of went into the psychology direction, and I was pursuing my graduate degree. And the funny thing is, I had been in the arts before that, and I had stopped reading. I mean, for like 20 years, I didn't read much. And so getting back into reading, and I did a video on how Jordan Peterson affected me after 40. And one way was just like really encouraging reading, and reading things that are very difficult, like things that are beyond me, but forcing myself to do it. And that was very transformative as well. And so then there was some experimentation with different things with Buddhism. I was very interested in Alan Watts, and he was an Episcopal minister too at one point. So he's someone who brought Eastern thought to the West in the 60s, but never, I don't think, ever became an atheist. So it was sort of integrated in there. And then there were just various sort of Eastern things I looked at, and I'd say do Eastern Zen type meditation to this day. And then it was that, a lot of it was that mental health agency and those folks. And I had a supervisor at the mental health agency who was a Catholic. Everything just kind of lined up. And she introduced me, and I'd be interested what you think of these people. She introduced me to Cynthia Bergeau and Richard Rohr.
Oh, Richard Rohr, I know who he is.
Yeah. And there's sort of that group that kind of integrate Buddhism. I don't know.
Yep.
What you think about that?
So John Van Donk, who I've spoken with before, he's on my channel. He's sort of been my partner in crime and mm-hmm. doing meetups. John Van Donk had been on a Richard Rohr weekend, which was really important for him. Mm-hmm. And he's been leaning on me to read more of Rohr's books. Mm-hmm. I did a conversation with Nathan Jacobs, which was really a lot of fun.
Yeah, because, I saw part of that.
Because his story too, I mean, he's a little younger than we are, but his story too has sort of that hero's journey about it that many of the other people that I'm talking to have. Mm-hmm. The things, the ideas he was emerging. He was also in art school. I've been amazed at how many artists listen to my channel because
you're high in openness.
that must be it. My older sister is an artist, and she's also much more open in terms of some of these religious boundaries than I am. And so maybe this is a good way to answer my question about Roar. So growing up in a fairly isolated, insulated religious subculture, but being high in openness leads to some fairly interesting things.
Yeah.
So my mother, I don't think is high in openness. My father, I think, was very high in openness, but, you know, born in the Depression to also a minister and his wife who, you know, that it's almost the, you know, who was it? Was it Nietzsche talked about how, you know, Catholicism sort of compressed European culture into that discipline? You know, Dutch Calvinism in the history of our family was a disciplined container that, if you're high in openness and a fairly pressurized, disciplined container, you tend to develop certain internal disciplines that you don't cross, but you don't tend to show the sort of dogmatism around those boundaries that others do. And I think that's probably what a lot of people who watch my channel pick up on, because whereas people, you know, maybe people were like, well, you know, are you Roman Catholic yet? Or when are you going to join the Orthodox Church? I'm like, no, I'm Dutch Calvinist. These are my people. I'm not going anywhere. I'm very happy in my little container, but I'm also very high in openness. And one of the things I learned from my father is to, you know, don't make judgments when you don't have to. And really the judgments I have to make are about my life. And other people are making other judgments. And in fact, Jesus says, don't judge. If you're Dutch Calvinist, you should probably listen to him. So, you know, so Roar is one of these, you know, Roar is a Roman Catholic priest who many, both within the Roman Catholic Church and conservative Protestant churches, would say he's sort of strayed from the reservation. And but at the same time, also, Roar is clearly someone who's high in openness, and in the, you know, in his desire to really help people, like my friend John Van Donk, he has helped a lot of people work on a lot of their issues. You know, so John Van Donk, in my interview with him, where we talked about his past, you know, talked about, you know, his father growing up, and actually shared some things on YouTube that he hadn't shared before. But if you bury things within an hour or 2 hours of video, I found it's usually pretty safe. Someone has to really want to get at you to dig through that 2 hours to get that tiny little bit of heresy you drop. So I, you know, part of what's interesting about America is that it takes these religious traditions from the Balkanized world, like Orthodoxy, for example, like, and brings it to America, and suddenly it's out there on the prairie and new connections and relationships can happen. And that's happening to the Orthodox Church right now, where
absolutely
that Peugeot is in. So, so Alan Watts, Richard Rohr, you began to see in your clinical work that, and I think this is very true. And when I'm going to talk to John Vervaeke at some point, but one of the things, because I know he wants to address the meaning crisis. One of the things that religion has showed an obvious capacity for is, weaponizing is too unkind a word, but I'm religious, so I'm going to use it. In a sense, weaponizing or making things viral. Because one of the things that I'm continually impressed with, especially in a secular age, is how capable religion was at delivering a mixed bag often, but things that helped people survive in terribly difficult places. And you see that with Frankl, because if there's a difficult place,
that is it.
That's the mother of all difficult places.
Yes, it is.
And he begins to realize that, wow, you can't live without meaning. And in fact, you can't live in Santa Barbara, California without meaning, much less that's kind of the other side to concentration camp. Mm-hmm. Santa Barbara, Santa Monica, mm-hmm. Santa Cruz, all these places the Catholics found and said, wow, we feel spiritual. So, so right now there's a lot of interesting, you get some interesting relationships when you have disciplined, structured religious communities, and then people who get high in openness. And one of the things that America does to these insulated, isolated religious communities is it takes down the walls. And so you have people leaving these enclaves, and now, whereas the wide open prairies might sometimes feel like liberation, they can also feel terrifying if they're the Serengeti and you know that there's lions in the bush. Mm-hmm. So you began to notice you began to appreciate the powerful capacity of, I'll say, religion and spirituality to heal people who perhaps didn't have, you know, a lot of money to pay a therapist to walk carefully through their pasts.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So how did that impact you?
So it really was impactful to me, this whole thing, because a lot of this is my, you know, not just with my clients, but I had to do this, my own journey first, and that is still developing, obviously. Let me just talk about C.S. Lewis for a minute, because even though I was all into this Eastern stuff, and I still, to some degree, am, I mean, I still admire, you know, I still listen to Alan Watts every now and then just to console me. But when I read C.S. Lewis, actually, the first book I ever read was The Screwtape Letters. And there's just something about it that I don't know what he does, but it connects to someone like me who's struggling with this. It's like, I don't know if I can do this right now, but this is a window into it. You know, this is actually, this seems legitimate. This seems like, you know, a God that could be real. And you know, it's funny, on the back of this book, well, first of all, I was reading this, trying to prepare myself, and I was hoping to read the whole thing, but I really got tripped up because, you know, the whole dialectic and the logic thing. I had to read that chapter a few times, but he said, I had it marked. I wish I could. Yes. Okay. So this is so good. I mean, this addresses what I'm going through, and I think what a lot of us are going through. Modern reader, how your spirits rise, how much more at home you would feel with an emergent rather than a transcendent God, how much less primitive, repugnant, and naive the emergent conception seems to you. For by that, you know, so that's the dilemma, I think, that we're struggling with. You know, like, you've got the two spiritual, I think somehow this sort of plays into God 1 and 2. You've got the sort of, well, if you just say it's a force in the world, and like I was saying, maybe it's Tao, you know, then you can go there, but not go all the way there. But at the same time, there's something about C.S. Lewis that makes you think, no, there is something, there is a bridge. You can go all the way there, but I don't know what it is yet. I'm just like skating around the periphery.
That fascinates me. And, you know, I've heard, and when I talk to Verveke, we'll get into this, I'm sure, because he says pretty much the same thing in terms of, well, Peugeot and Vanderclay, I really respect their projects, but, you know, we're doomed to failure. which is so funny to me, because, you know, I say, look at a story like Nathan Jacobs, and I think that story for me is so easy to believe. And so then we get into questions of upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, miracles, I think Lewis abandoned writing books like miracles because he understood what limited tools they are. And I think that's why he started writing children's books.
Mm.
Because he realized it's really hard to get into this unless you are a child. And Jesus says almost that exact thing.
That's interesting.
And so there's a those Narnia books that have often been treated sort of like a C.S. Lewis hobby. Some more recent scholarship has looked at them, and I think really the book Planet Narnia really took it a lot. I think a Cambridge or an Oxford scholar is taking this on, but looking at those books and saying what Lewis is sort of doing is attempting to do that thing that Peterson says can't be done, which is to write fairy tales. And he's enacting all sorts of archetypal things that, of course, Tolkien didn't like what Lewis was doing in Narnia, but and I think Lewis saw in miracles that a lot of this rational apologetics is talking to the rider and going to Jonathan Haidt's rider and elephant.
Yeah, sure.
And it's really the elephant that matters.
It's the elephant that matters.
And you know that as a therapist. Yeah.
Well, and also from reading Haidt, which is that book is so influential to me, and I'm sure to other people. It's just like, wow, that is how people are.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know.
So you read The Happiness Hypothesis.
I read the Righteous Mind.
Okay, you should definitely read The Happiness Hypothesis. I think it's his best book.
Okay, yeah. It's on my
list.
The other
books are excellent, but yeah. The Happiness Hypothesis is sort of his maps of meaning.
Really good. Good to know. I'll definitely read that one.
But it's a lot easier to read than Maps of Meaning.
Yeah. Did you read Maps of Meaning?
No. Trying to read ongoing project. Yes.
It took me 3 months.
I believe it. I still say it's a tortured book. And when he describes how he wrote it, that's how it reads.
it's hard to believe that you know, after you read that, and how it's hard to believe at the end of that he didn't believe, you know, that he couldn't say. I shouldn't say anything because I can't say it either, but you know, and it's so it just really parallels. I mean, obviously it doesn't parallel, but I can sense. But it's still hard for me to believe after all that he couldn't say God is real.
Well, I think he says God is real. It just depends on what you mean by God.
Yeah. There we go. Okay.
And you know, this from a guy who, you know, if you dig deep into especially some of the smaller interviews, he's fairly open.
Yeah.
The last video I posted, you know, when God talks back, I was so delighted to have this woman contact me because she was so open about her visions and experiences that as a pastor, especially within a religious context, people have these kinds of experiences a lot. And in our secular world, it's sort of the reverse of church. If you talk about these things in public, you lose status. And so people have these experiences, but they don't talk about them. And Peterson is one of these people that I suspect, I haven't talked with him about this, but I suspect he is one of these people that has a lot of these experiences. Mm-hmm. The difficulty we have in the secular realm is that we don't know what to do with them. We have a great deal of cultural machinery and motivated reason to dismiss them quickly.
Yeah.
But they are like the other things we've talked about. Yeah. the areas in our relationship with the universe mm-hmm. that we don't want to talk about. So I think Peterson remains in that place, but he is high in openness, and mm-hmm. I'm most interested, obviously, in the kinds of conversations he's having with people like Bishop Barron mm-hmm. and like David Nasser.
Yeah.
And I, in both cases of those interviews, I think they would have been better if they had let Peterson do more talking.
I think you're right.
Because as a pastor, and I know you know this as a therapist, people talk their way into their answers.
That's right. Yeah.
Which is probably why you and I are doing videos.
It's exactly why you and I are doing videos. We're working it out.
and other people, that's not, the crazy thing isn't that we're doing videos. The crazy thing is that other people are watching, which is also telling.
Yes.
So, okay, so you... This wall that, obviously, mm-hmm. as a pastor, a big part of my job is to help people over the wall.
Yeah.
And I think it's helpful that I'm upfront as a pastor, because it's really weird, because even though it's my job to help people over the wall, I found that the minute you get too eager about that, people are like, I'm not going anywhere near that wall, mm-hmm. which is why... Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. And another thing is, like, if as a person who would like to get there, I'm scared to be too eager about it because I don't want it not to be real.
Right.
You know.
And what do you mean by real?
Well, it has to feel, you know, like that, like I was saying, when I read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, I felt that embodied, yes, this is it. This is the substrate of reality. That's what I would need to feel to believe. If that makes sense.
So it's more an intuitive embrace.
Yes.
I'm not dismissing that at all.
No. I mean, I'm trying to answer this. I'm trying to answer this as like as carefully as I can. Yes, it's an intuitive embrace. It needs to be embodied. But at the same time, when I read the argument of C.S. Lewis, there's something transformative in that argument as well. Yeah. You know, there's something like, let's just go back to, you know, the postmodern period of my life and all that stuff and the irony. And what we dismissed, you know, on principle was things like the moral law. Then you read C.S. Lewis' explanation of the moral law and you go, this sounds right.
Have you read The Problem of Pain yet?
No, I've only read, actually my godmother gave me Mere Christianity right about the time that I started watching you talk about Lewis.
So
that was really helpful to me. And I read Screwtape and then halfway through, not even halfway through Miracles because I got tripped up in that logic section. But no, I mean, I'm definitely, this is going to be part of my future reading.
Yeah.
Because it's really amazing.
It's, as someone whose job it is to help people over the wall, mm-hmm. You know, dealing with that wall myself, because one of the things that I learn as a pastor, you know, it's probably analogous to the weirdness of trying to be a put together person and a therapist mm-hmm. is trying to be.
Most of us aren't all that put together.
That's exactly right.
That's why we get into it.
Exactly. Which is trying to be a Christian and a pastor
mm-hmm.
because here I'm supposed to help people over the wall, but I've got all my own feelings about that wall too. And, you know, one of the things I love about Lewis is that portion in Miracles that you cited, mm-hmm. I found in myself, I very much want God to stay on the God number one side of the line because I'm very number two-ish. And we number two people who can look at, that can figure out patterns and look for machinery. I mean, when it comes to, so pastors not only deal with people as individuals, they deal with people in highly complex long-term communities, which are churches. You very quickly see that there's using and loving, and you watch people try to use each other. And I don't mean that, well, sometimes in a really ugly way, but most of the time it's, well, you know, these little things need to get done at church, yeah, and I want to manipulate someone into doing, yeah, it for me. And, you know, it's the usual stuff that goes on in families. Churches are sort,
sure,
of
a family, yeah,
bigger families. Yeah. But yeah, this, you know, belief in the modern realm is fraught. And but I'm not entirely sure that belief in the ancient world was all that unfraught when you read things like the Bible.
Yeah.
And the Psalms.
Yeah.
Where people are crying out in pain over, you know, mm-hmm, the problems in their life. And we who have so many fewer problems cry out in pain.
So many fewer.
Over yeah, we don't diminish the problems.
Yeah. So
I don't know. I wouldn't mind getting into Art Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance a little bit, because that's sort of what you've done, unless you want to pursue something else a little bit more. I've been doing way too much talking in this video, and it's because you're a therapist. And so you're using those therapist tricks like I use those pastor tricks on people usually on the other side of this to get them talking.
No, so, you're probably right. I do have a tendency to hold back. So the metaphysics of quality sort of, I tried to describe them to the best of my ability in the last video, that, you know, the second part. I don't fully understand it, because there's this whole moral component, and that is that inorganic is, and when you use, he uses the word moral, not in the same way that we do, or not in the same way that C.S. Lewis does. It's just like things, there's this drive towards, let's just say, quality drives the universe, and this is what is better, and what is better is what is more free. And it's something like, and this is my interpretation, it's something like we're limited beings, but we are expanding towards less and less limitation. So things start very limited at the bottom, you know, the Big Bang, and then there's inorganic matter, and at some point it gets complex enough. And Verveke talks about this too. He says, you know, things grow in complexity. So it becomes complex enough that the carbon in inorganic becomes so complex it can produce life. So then you have the biological level, and those two are objective. From biology, you get human beings, and then you get society, and in society, you get social patterns. So the third level is social, and they're called levels of quality, static levels of quality. And then the fourth is intellectual, and these two upper levels are subjective. So what's so interesting to me, the thing that really did it for me was this thing, Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris, the truth, remember those, the truth thing, that painful truth podcast, and then they did a second one. But what I took out of that was that the subjective is just as real as the objective. And this is what gets me. This distinction is what is the undercurrent that I see in all the things I'm interested in Verveke and Peugeot. I think your work has this underlying metaphysics of quality, and all the things that draw me, and you know, have that. So that way of seeing the world, I think, is so productive. And as we, and there's a term that Pirsig has, which is the analytical knife. It's just the more you know, I just did chapter 10. I'm reading the whole book and putting it online. In chapter 10, he says that the young Phaedrus, he goes to school, he's 15 years old. This is the character in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. He started noticing that the more experiments you do, the more objects you produce, you know, the more objects of consideration you produce, and then it just explodes, and then there's so much stuff, and you don't get any closer to truth. You know, you just are just cutting things and cutting things and cutting things in the material world. And so you can't start looking at you and things in the world, like Peterson said. It's not us and things in the world. It's the meaning. It's the phenomenological reality that is reality. And so that concept with Peterson really blew me away. And I think that's where I made the connection with Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And it actually goes into Lila, which is the second book, which is where he takes what he's looking at in the first book and turns it into an actual philosophy, you know, the metaphysics of quality. And so it's just seeing that underlying metaphysics in everything. And I think with this particular metaphysics, God can be in there, because the drive is to the better. It's towards the good. It's toward closer to God, if God is no limitations, like Peterson said, omnipresent, omnipotent, and the third thing, which
omniscient.
Omniscient, that's it. Limitless, where we are ensconced in this limitation, but we grow further and further out into the limitless. So what does that mean? That means we're going closer to God as we increase in, and that's why the upward trajectory of the metaphysics of quality is a moral one, because it's going closer to, let's just say, God. I think that they can parallel. And there's many, many more things to say about the metaphysics of quality. And of course, one thing I love about this channel is people who have like been piercing addicts for years are saying, no, here's where you're wrong, here's where you're right, you know, and it's really cool.
Oh, that's terrific. So after you made the Verveke Peugeot video, mm-hmm. I looked at your channel, saw all the stuff on Zen and the Art of, I've always mm-hmm. had a guilt, you know, there's all these, guilt isn't the wrong word, it's sheepishness. There's all these books I haven't read. And a lot of people have read that book and raved about that book, and I never read it. So I picked it up, and I've started reading it along with the half dozen of other books I'm reading right now. But I was really interested. I really liked the first chapter or the first few chapters. And when did you write it?
He wrote it in 1968. It took him a really long time to get it published. No one wanted it.
It feels like the late 60s, early 70s, the book does.
The Trip is 1968. It gets published in 1972. And it took him, like, he went through 120 publishers. 121 said, this is going to be a great classic. And they published it.
Really?
Yep.
Well, that should give all of us who have little YouTube channels
Absolutely.
Hope, shouldn't it? People don't, we don't know what's good for us. That's how we are. And it's interesting, because I saw that John Verveke put a comment in one of your videos about Plotinus and Neoplatonism. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. I'll have to pursue that too. This is some interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. I really love the line here. I've learned now to take notes as I do these conversations it's just such a simple thing. The subjective is just as real as the objective. Mm-hmm. And I think, so part of my quest has been, okay, so why did Peterson strike such a nerve? And I think that's a big part of it.
I think so.
He's been able to make that point in a compelling way.
Yeah.
So then the question is, what part of our minds that we are disconnected from have known this, and why have we locked it away and shut it up?
Well, Peirceg would say that this is the ghost of reason. It's like, you know how Peugeot says there's a medieval worldview. And it is, and I think Verveke said it's all one, it's just levels of power. You know, I'm not going to really get this right, so I'm sorry, but it's something like the medieval worldview is the symbols are as alive as the actual, you know, the patterns of connection with God are as real as the actual material in the world. In fact, probably they're more real. And it's not until we discover rationality that we actually, you know, have a relationship with the physical world, something like that. Like I said, I'm probably not going to get this right. I don't have a background in philosophy, and it's really tripping me up these days.
You're too darn old to get that stuff. Why didn't we study that when we were young?
I know. but it's, you know, it's that, I mean, I think that Peterson, Sam Harris interview was really groundbreaking in this regard.
With the first two podcasts?
Yeah, the first two podcasts where this notion, actually there's one a little bit earlier that he does with some other documentary with, I don't remember who they were, but this is where this notion of, you know, it's meaning, not material. And that's the only way to deal with, I think, the way the world has become so complex. You know, every moment there's a new thing produced, you know, not just in the material world, but you've got all these new things to think about. Right now we're producing another thing for people to think about. It's too complex. And this is what Vivekananda is saying. It's crazy. You have to see the underlying patterns anymore. You can't just see the stuff in the world and be dealing with that. You know, so in Peirce, he would say the ghost of reason started this trajectory, started us in this direction, removed us, put us in contact with the material world. It's the ghost of Newton. It's the ghost of his big bugaboo is Aristotle. He said that the problem began when Aristotle, it starts in Plato in the Phaedrus dialogue, but right in there, the prevailing good was arete, you know, excellence.
Yeah.
And Aristotle and Plato says, no, we need to separate love from reason. And then reason predominates in Aristotle, and it's uphill or downhill from there, depending on how you see it. So that's the ghost of reason. It's that division.
And that division, you know, it's all of these, so heaven and earth. So Vivekananda talks about the axial age divide. Mm-hmm. The thing that, you know, the thing that I was playing with C.S. Lewis when I found Peterson, actually, there are some real early YouTubes that you can find in my channel where I'm in front of a whiteboard because I'm playing with YouTube too and trying to figure out how I could put slides on video and all that stuff. But, you know, one of the things that drove me here was studying the Bible. And if you read Genesis 1, you get the idea that, well, there's tohu wavohu, there's the sea and everything. And then God, you know, let there be light. And I read mm-hmm. John Walton, and he asked the question, which I had never thought of before. Why does God call the light day and the darkness night? Why doesn't he call light, light? It's like, how many people have been reading that book and nobody paid attention to the fact that God called the light day? And so what does that mean? And then on and on. And so I was one of the people, and I know I'm going to get comments for this, that says, I think Genesis 1 reflects the cosmology of the ancient world, that you have a flat earth on pillars with mm-hmm. a dome on top. You have the sun, moon, and stars all within the firmament. You have waters above and you have waters below, and the flood is, you know, you open the gates of heaven and the gates of the bottom, and then the waters come during the flood, and then God drains them out again. That's the shape of the early chapters of Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in a
interesting.
Well, yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah. And I used to, in my sophomoric sense, have fun with people who were biblical literalists and ask them mm-hmm. naughty questions like, well, did the Apollo mission have to go through the water? Oh, the water is clouds. Oh, really? But why are the sun, moon, and stars below the waters and not above them? I mean, all these questions. So if you're in a religious community that strives to take the Bible seriously, these become live topics, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure.
And so I was really grappling with the question of, well, you know, every Ascension Day, Jesus goes up. Well, if a in an Old Testament cosmology, well, you've got God's temple up on top and his temple down below. And once you, like a lot of the Peugeot stuff, once you begin to understand the symbolism of that world, well, the Bible makes a whole lot more sense.
The underlying pattern, yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
But here we are on this globe, going around the sun. Mm-hmm. Here we have all this space. So Jesus ascends. Where does he go? Well, a cloud covers him. Okay. Well, he's seated at the right hand of the Father. This is the Apostles' Creed. And so in a sense, I've got, as a pastor, I'm supposed to connect people between these two worlds, the world of the Bible and the world of their daily lives. Well, we're talking about walls. We have a wall between these two worlds. And for the most part, because we're human beings, we can ignore these walls and not talk about these things. Because people in church, that their conservative Christian tradition gives them things that they are not willing to give up. Gives them meaning, gives them comfort, affords them community. I mean, these are the kinds of things that people, you know, spend considerable amounts of time and money on because it's worth that much to them.
Yeah.
And we've had, obviously, over the last few hundred years, a cultural fight about, can you really believe this stuff? And then the really hard question, how can you believe this stuff? And so Peterson comes along, and I just intuitively, I knew he's addressing this divide. And I didn't, you know, and this is where I think Jung is helpful because Jung actually was part of this, but not just Jung, but also Northrop Frye and, you know, Blake and just a whole bunch of people who've been talking about this stuff. And so getting into the question, the metaphysical question, and, you know, one of the things that I caught when, you know, watching your channel, you're talking metaphysics. And what's really interesting is that in many ways, metaphysics has been off the topic of conversation since the Enlightenment.
Yeah, it's why Peterson is not taken seriously as a philosopher.
Yeah, because we don't want to talk metaphysics.
Yeah.
Because just like religious people don't want to open that can of worms of asking the question and saying, what does it mean that Genesis has us living under a bowl on a flat earth? Modernist people don't want to open that can of metaphysics and say, no, we resolved that in the Enlightenment. Let's not talk about that. And so one of the things, so again, John will probably watch this. I should send him an email after this and say, John, let's set up a conversation because our list is stacking up.
I can't wait.
You know, I think John, well, he's a physicalist. I mean, he's talked about that. One of the things that being, for example, a Christian does, if you're a metaphysical Christian who you believe that, if you believe that, in fact, the subjective, which is the great subjective, which is God, you know, the subjective is foundational and the material is derivative. Which is in very many ways the big boundary marker that people face when it comes to talking about miracles or things like that. Well, that's metaphysics. And in a lot of ways, Paul Maxwell, who is a conservative reformed, he taught philosophy. I don't know where he stopped making videos. He probably got into trouble. He's in a community that's even more conservative than I am. But he made the point that one of the cool ways, he has this great video, basically how to talk philosophy in 20 minutes. I thought, ooh, I got to watch this. But he says, basically, you know, you have the ancient, you have the modern, and you have the postmodern. And then you have metaphysics, and you have epistemology, and you have axiology. Axiology is basically ethics. These three things line up. The ancients dealt with metaphysics. The moderns deal in epistemology, and the postmoderns deal in axiology. When I listen to a lot of
makes sense
moderns, they don't want to go down to metaphysics. And Peterson keeps dipping into that level.
Yeah.
And that's what makes Sam Harris nervous.
Yeah.
Because we don't go there. And I think you're right. So Persig said, no, we better talk metaphysics. And everybody said,
yeah, he's a niche philosopher. And I find that unfortunate because I find it so useful for actually dealing in real life. I mean, like I said, I'm trying to bridge a gap in a way that that I could, you know, articulate how it can be useful. But just an embodied sense to see the world through that lens, it makes, you know, it makes things make so much more sense.
Yeah. Well, and it also, so as a Christian, you know, this is where so often with Christianity, all roads lead back to this empty tomb of Jesus. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, so as a pastor, you know, you grow up, and I grew up with Stan and Barb, and then you go to college, and you go to seminary, and then I was a missionary, and that forces you to ask a lot of really uncomfortable questions. And then you're in North America, and you're preaching to these people all the time, so you're always looking in the Bible and trying to connect it between, well, and over years of studying Jesus and the Bible and all of this stuff, you know, I really begin to realize some of the things that Jesus is saying is really costly. I mean, he talks about turning the other cheek. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, I think what happens is that there's this veneer of nobility. If you turn the other cheek, people say, oh, how noble, and leave you alone. Nah, usually in the real world, you get hit again. Mm-hmm. and especially, you know, the way in our world that we get hit, you get hit in relationships. And so you start listening to Jesus and you begin to realize that, you know, if you live the way he lived, you'll probably die the way he died. And even though people are, you know, oh, I don't know about that resurrection. Well, it's not unbelievable to imagine his crucifixion, because the Romans were really good at that.
Yeah.
And once you get into your mind that, oh, it sounds so high-minded to live the way Jesus lived, it sounds terribly unpragmatic to die the way Jesus died. Mm-hmm. You know, at the age of 33, betrayed by your own countrymen to the imperial overlords. You know, most of us don't connect that with our best life now. So then you get into the resurrection, because Jesus only really makes sense if it isn't just some kind of noble idea.
Yeah.
But it's a promise that says pouring out your life. And see, this is meaningful to me because of my father's life. My father poured out his life to mostly help poor people get through a very hard world. Mm-hmm. Now, all of us look at that and say, oh, that's very noble. I'm sure glad other people are doing it. Because my father, however, would never have exchanged that, because, of course, his life was full of meaning.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yes.
So this resurrection business gets into metaphysics.
Yeah.
Because
I think very much so. I think like the Trinity that Peugeot expresses, that, I mean, I think that is metaphysics, really. Yeah. I mean, again, I don't have much of a philosophy background, but intuitively, does that feel right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's because the crazy thing about Jesus' resurrection is that it isn't just, a second chance at another stab at this world. In the Bible, Jesus' resurrection is the beginning of the remaking of the universe.
Yeah.
Well, you start talking about that stuff. and now we're really off the reservation in terms of secularity.
Yeah.
And so then if you're going to premise your moral decisions and your daily decisions based on that assertion, well, even though we've been living with Christianity for 2,000 years, you start going down that road, and you start going down this road of people like St. Francis of Assisi and people that we look at and say, oh, wow, they were wonderful. But as C.S. Lewis notes, and as the Apostle Paul notes, if this entire meta-narrative, which has dramatic metaphysical assertions about the resurrection, if that isn't true, then St. Francis was really an idiot. And this boils down to my little life. And so that's, I don't know. See, you're a crafty therapist. You really I got Peugeot talking in one of my interviews with him. I felt a little proud and a little sheepish about that, but that's those pastor tricks. So I'm going to shut up.
Well, one thing I wanted to say is you use the word promise. And I think this is what's so powerful about Christianity, is that if you are saying that it is promised to you that after chaos will be a new, you know, this, and I think this is what Peugeot says, after the cycle is over, you know, we're looking at things now and they seem insane in a lot of ways. But if you're not looking at it in the right way, you know, it seems like it's going downhill and that's the end of it, and nuclear war, whatever. But if you're looking at it in the right way, you see the seeds of something much, much better.
Yeah.
You know, for one thing, at the very least, poverty is being alleviated. It really is.
Yeah.
You know, along with it comes a new set of problems. But nonetheless, you see that these problems are you thought were impenetrable. I mean, let me go back to New York in the 80s. You know, that's people. I was in art school. You know what was happening then. And we thought that this was it. This is never going to be cured and everyone's going to die.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, from that, well, for one thing, the stigma that gay people felt was kind of transcended because it was all out there in the open. So that happened. New drugs had to be developed. You know, just all this stuff within that is a promise of something emerging out of it, resurrection of something better from this thing that has to, you know, that has to decay and die off. This is very much part of Piercing too. You've got these, he has this concept in Lila, the brujo, the magician. And it takes place in the Native American community. And it's like this transition in between the old way, like the priests, you know, not that what happened with the Native Americans was good, that they, you know, that they got involved with the white men, let's just say. But at the time, you know, if they didn't integrate with the invaders, they would be annihilated. So this brujo understands, this magician, the priests say, no, stay away from them. And this magician says, no, we, you know, and the funny thing is, this magician is just like a degenerate, and he's a drunk, and he's a peeping Tom. You know, he's like this in Jung, he's sort of the trickster who becomes, the trickster is like the transitional element to the Christ figure, to the hero, to the messianic figure. He becomes the transformative element that takes the old way into the new way. And that's in Piercing, you know, you have this notion of dynamic quality. This is the thing that can't be named. This is the force. This is probably as close to what is behind the Trinity as can be expressed. It's this thing that goes to the old and transforms it into something new. And this is the way of evolution. This is the way towards the higher moral planes. And so I love the notion of the promise, because to me it expresses that. It expresses don't become hopeless, don't become nihilistic, because no matter how bad things are, there will be another phase. And that to me is so powerful. And if you see that, then you can see, let's just say quality is such a big part of Piercing's work, then you can see in the chaos, you can see the quality, and you can go to that, and you can nurture the quality, if that makes any sense.
Now, how does he deal with the individual? Because one of the things that I see is that people get caught up in a hopeful narrative for humanity or us. But one of the things that I really appreciate about Christianity and is that there needs to be hope for the community, but there also needs to be hope for the individual. And for me, part of the reason why, you know, I really well, I'm really not going to move from where I'm at, is exactly that, that you need hope at both levels. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, I've learned a lot from Jonathan Pageau about, mm-hmm. you know, hierarchies and multiplicity and, you know, how those things work together well. So how does Persig deal with the individual and the communal in this?
So Persig uses, like, quality is a thing that infiltrates, you know, and that's why I like kind of to use Tao to kind of describe. I mean, in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, he goes through the whole thing: is it Tao? Is it not Tao? There's this thing which is. Do you remember in Peterson when he talked about Yak Pangsep, the seeking system? You know, it's always towards the better. I mean, in an animal without any intellectual, capacity, they're just going towards what's better, what's going to improve your life at that point. So the individual connects, like, you sense quality. You know, certain things can get in the way. I like John Vervaeke's bullshit thing. You know, you can get distracted by something that isn't this low quality and think it's high quality. But if you are in the right frame of mind, you know, I guess you could call it meditative consciousness. This is where I'm trying to work on it so it actually becomes something that people can use. But if you are in the mindset that quality exists and all you have to do is wait for it to merge because it's going to come to you. It's going to, you know, you're going to sense what is higher, what is quality, and that is what you're looking for. And then to be engaged in that in your day-to-day life, he calls, Vervaeke called it the flow state. Pearson calls it gumption. It means that, you know, the desire to connect with something and be involved with it. And then he has a little section in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, how to get your gumption back, basically. But for the individual, it's being aware, you know, it's very much like, this is why I like Vervaeke a lot, because it's applied metaphysics, let's just say.
Yeah.
I mean, he has practices and stuff. It's like, you know, sharpen up your bullshit detector.
One of the things that I've been thinking about in my whole journey with this is, in fact, Peterson in the video conversations that he did with Sam Harris very much got into this question of, I call it orientation, mm-hmm. because Sam Harris wants to say that, well, we all know the good. And I hear that and I say, yes and no. Because, you know, if you watch people, I was just writing about this on an online forum for a little group of CRC people that mm-hmm. I chat with online. You know, we have this idea, you know, in the area of sexuality, of consent. Mm-hmm. And consent has become consent in terms of sexual morality in our nation has increasingly become the lodestone. I mean, if there's consent, it's moral.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
Consent is a really nice term for choosing. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you'd swap out choosing for consent and apply that to people's lives, they would very quickly tell you that they've made things called bad decisions. Mm-hmm. And every bad decision is completely consensual because it's mm-hmm. a decision.
Yeah.
And the difficulty that we have is, and this is, I want to do some treatment on some of Peterson's more recent videos mm-hmm. that he's done, because he's talking a lot about consciousness. Mm-hmm. And those don't tend to be the parts of his talks that people are paying a lot of attention to. But, and consciousness, I'm going to have to do a words that fudge on the word consciousness. You know, I see it very practically. Consciousness is this little space that we use mm-hmm. where we experience ourselves and where we tend to interact with the rest of the world. And that consciousness has a very tortured relationship with time. Because consciousness seems to be sort of timeless, but not in a permanent objectivist way. Mm-hmm. And we like to talk about you know, I live in Northern California, and everyone, for a while, everyone was talking about living in the moment, that that was the best thing you could do. And at the same time, I had a alcoholic, bipolar, homeless man refusing to live anywhere but against the outside of my office door. And I thought, I know someone who lives completely in the moment. It's him. Most of these people talking wistfully about living in the moment don't want to live like him. And so, you know, consent happens in this little moment of consciousness. And we're really bad at it. We make terrible decisions.
And this is the whole problem with this. This is what I'm struggling with. I mean, there he has in there a morality. You know, you choose the intellectual over the, you know, if push comes to shove, you choose the higher level over the lower level. For example, in India, you don't eat the sacred cows, you know, because of the biological level. But if everyone's starving, you eat the sacred cows because you don't want to sacrifice the human for the animal, something like that. So the morality itself is the hardest part to understand of the metaphysics of quality and the hardest thing to apply. And, you know, I'm thinking as we're speaking, if you had a moral law like C.S. Lewis's, a lot of that is solved.
Yeah. Well, and what religions do is takes consciousness and, in a sense, liberates you from some of the limitations of, because if your moral law is consent, you know, I use the example of, apparently in some school somewhere, there was a high school student. She was, you know, very attractive, 18-year-old who came from not a great family and wasn't a lot of money, so decided basically to do online porn to make money. Now, the school quite rightly and rationally said, oh, this could be a problem. Because if you understand a whole, you know, few hundred or a thousand 15 to 18-year-old boys and girls and the internet, this could be a problem. And very quickly, she was surrounded by parents and activists and media that was basically saying, this is her right to make money in this way. Well, that 18-year-old consenter, when she becomes 25, those decisions she made at 18 might not look so good. And in this age of the kind of power we have delivered to us via the internet, So when you have something like religion, well, what religion, even in strictly Petersonian terms, is this accumulated knowledge that has sort of been Darwinian tested over vast periods of time in a whole variety of cultural frameworks.
Right.
Well, yeah, and that gets into Verveke's wisdom. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a pretty valuable commodity. Now you have Brett Weinstein's caution, which I take very seriously, that now in different contexts, this wisdom is going to function in different ways. What religious traditions tend to do, unlike the kind of propaganda you might hear from certain religious people, that, well, I believe the Bible just as it's written. I listen to people say that and I think, I've read the Bible. You hardly do. because what religious traditions is sort of act like an epigenetic layer to the genetics of the Bible. And they sort of turn on and turn off different passages along the way. And of course, Sam Harris will say, you're being arbitrary. No, they're not being arbitrary. They're just doing the epigenetic thing. So, and you know, which then leads you to the conclusion, which many have noted, that, well, religions likely wouldn't have developed unless they offered an adaptive advantage to communities over their competitors.
Right.
So, but then we get to the point of, well, now, in a sense, we've gotten so full of ourselves, as many generations since the Enlightenment have, and think, oh, we see through all this stuff, and so we don't need it anymore for us. And then, of course, we look at the wreckage of our lives and say, ooh, maybe I need something more.
Exactly. And who knows where we're going to go then, you know?
Yeah, well, that's
what guru, what expensive spiritual online modality, you know, there's a whole lot of places that people go for that that kind of don't really line up with who we are.
Well, I have talked a lot and we've gone for about an hour and a half. Is there, you know, I should shut up because.
I think there was one thing. Let me see. I think there was one thing I wanted to make sure to get in. So I listened to the second Pageot interview the discussion that you two had, and you were talking about patterns that are demons and angels. You know that these that you're describing something that sort of comes in and infiltrates you, and we have these demons within ourselves. I think one really great way to see ourselves as, you know, full of these different, I like this in Peterson too, sub-personalities. And I think that, and I don't know how I'm going to integrate this because these are two things that I know intuitively so well. You know, I feel these, like the metaphysical quality somewhere in there and the morality and everything that we're talking about that I'm trying to work out. And this way of seeing ourselves as sub-personalities, you know, just parts of ourselves, this is the way that makes sense. There's a great, an amazing book that I'm going to be talking about later. It's called The Way We Are by Frank Putnam. And he's someone who his background, he wrote the first book on multiple personality disorder, the first clinical book. He says that babies have states that they're born with, you know, the different states, and they constellate around emotions more or less, but these are specific states. And you move from state to state with this kind of dynamic. The dynamic turns out to be dynamical systems, you know, that chaos, the way that chaos, you know, the chaos there, and Dravecki talks about this. There's a movement. There's an inherent movement that seems to be in nature that is described by dynamical systems theory, and our moods and our states sort of transition with this kind of undercurrent. So I just wanted to mention that there's really a lot of evidence to even see ourselves as multiple in a way. And that was very interesting listening to the Pageot interview, because these symbols of demons and angels, it kind of plays into that too. And I don't really know where I'm going with that, but I wanted to mention it because it's out there in my mind. And I was wondering what you thought about that.
No, that's right. and we use that. So yeah. You know, with the Owen Barfield stuff, if you pay attention to our language, language, not only is the Bible full of language, and we call it revelation if you're a Christian, as if you're a therapist and a pastor, you know that every time we open our mouth, it's a certain kind of revelation too. Mm-hmm. And if you look at our language, you know, you're old enough to remember Flip Wilson, "The Devil Made Me Do It."
Yeah. Exactly.
And you know, I've actually talked quite a bit about that we should probably talk again. I've thought a lot about where that conversation went. And part of what I think we're dealing with is a sort of spiritual Turing test. And so the Turing test is, of mm-hmm. course, the question of, can they develop a computer that is smart enough, let's say on the other end of a telephone line, to fool us into imagine we're talking to a human being? And we're getting to that point now, because now you pick up a phone and there's a telemarketer, and sometimes it's like, Well, spiritually we have that problem. Mm-hmm. Because when does complexity get to the point that it is indistinguishable for us from personhood? And that both scales up. You know, Freud would say, well, we projected God into the sky. But you apply the Turing test to that. That it scales up into the sky. It also scales down into us. Mm-hmm. And Peterson often talks about these sub-personalities that we have going. And anyone who is paying attention to themselves sufficiently knows that there are lots of different me that comes out, often by virtue of the context or the group of people that I'm mm-hmm. with. And obviously we choose to be integrated persons who are, well, why we want this is a whole nother conversation. Why we want to be the same person everywhere we're at. And, you know, for me who went overseas in my, how old was I when we left? In my mid-20s and had to learn another language and had to live in another language, you know, then you really begin to recognize that there was a Paul Vanderclay who was a missionary in the Dominican Republic and spoke Spanish, and a Paul Vanderclay who spoke English. Mm-hmm. And so, and then you get to the question of, you know, when, how am I an individual? I'm sort of, so my youngest sister passed away.
Yes, and November. I'm sorry about that. My condolences.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I had a loss, very similar one, and which is why a lot of the spiritual development has been very, very useful to me. So,
one of the things that I was talking to a pastor, when my father died, I was talking to a pastor friend, and that hit me, and I said to my pastor friend, without completely unconscious, I have to figure out what to think about this. And he stopped and said, why didn't you say what you feel about this? Well, that's pretty revelatory in terms of how my head works. Mm-hmm. But so my sister dies, and I'm watching myself, I'm watching my mother, I'm watching my sister, I'm watching her husband, her three young adult children, and I'm thinking, what strange individuals we are, that we are so deeply tied to each other. We have these boundaries of skin. We have these boundaries of space. We have these boundaries of, you know, I love how Vervaeke talks about us in terms of our autobiographical narrative. And that, in a sense, is ourselves.
Yeah.
The self that we experience. And so all of us know that we are going to die. I never would have said that none of my sisters or my parents will die. But when my sister dies suddenly, why does that send, and not just, you know, so my sister was an astounding and beloved teacher, middle school teacher of English. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, she was a leader in her school. And when she died, so she just left a crater.
Oh yeah.
On so many levels. And I'm watching this and thinking, what are we?
Yeah.
You know, how I have an older sister and a younger mm-hmm. sister, and we're all quite different, but yet we're brothers and sisters and raised by two parents in the same place. And so we've all got huge, we have no idea what we are.
Isn't that the case?
So, yeah, yeah. And angels and demons.
Yeah, I love that talk.
Yeah. I actually, when I was done with that talk, I kind of thought, oh, that didn't go so well, but
I thought it was great.
Jonathan and I should really talk again. But, and you and I should talk again. This, I thought,
I'd love to.
I thought this went very well, and I think
I did too. And thank you so much. I learned so much.
Oh, I have too. Next time I have to shut up more, because I did to Jonathan what you did to me, and maybe you didn't do it. Maybe I'm just thinking I did it. But
well, I'm working out a lot of stuff, so maybe I'll have it more coherent next time. And so thank you so much. This has been great.
Well, I very much appreciate your time, and
I appreciate yours.
And I will likely post this tomorrow, and okay. I hope it gives your channel lots more traffic.
Well, you did. You know, that was very nice of you. You did give my channel a lot more traffic, and a lot of your the people who listened to you came and commented on mine, and that was great to have these, you know, different perspectives. So I really appreciate the people who came over and you know, put in comments, because that's what it's all about. I mean, it's about getting feedback and learning things, and you know, as we learn, our own understandings of what we're working on just become so much better.
Yeah. No, I agree. And you know, when I started this thing, I had a lot of trepidation about the infamous YouTube comments section.
Yeah.
But at least on our smaller channels.
Yeah.
It's been wonderful.
Totally. Yeah, I love your comments. I love reading your comments. And I don't think we have to worry about all that stuff that these big wigs have to worry about. Yeah. We can have our community here and, you know, really exchange ideas and keep learning, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so thank you.
Well, thank you. Let this set this thing out and give it a deep soak, and then maybe a few months from now we'll come back and see where we're both at.
Sounds good.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay. Have a wonderful week.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.